The Academy Julian is the third story in the travels of Jim Galgadet. If you haven't listened to the first two, you can find them at thechroniclesofchesterfritz.com. This story is parked at a three-way intersection, incorporating two distinct elements of Lovecraftian fiction, the book Unaussprechlichen Kulten, and the art of necromancy, as described in the novella The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. There are also elements from the Yellow Mythos. If you're not familiar with the Yellow Mythos, I'll bring you up to speed after the story. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy The Academy Julian. Jim was leaning against the painted metal doorframe, scribbling at a newspaper crossword puzzle. He righted himself when his name was called. The entrance of the Academy Julian lacked any sort of waiting area. He had located an administrative office near the entrance, and had managed with no small degree of confusion to communicate his purpose across the language barrier. The building had clearly been designed with the idea that if you were already there, you knew where you ought to be. This design principle did not apply in Jim's case, and so he waited while the receptionist rang for Dominique Jackson. The woman, when she arrived, was dark-skinned and elegant. The mix of high-end fashion and a bold crown of curly black hair left Jim feeling shabby and provincial. The woman greeted him with a warm smile, and Jim was pleasantly surprised to hear a clear American accent. Dominique asked to check Jim's passport, and then signed him into the Academy Julian's visitor log. Afterward, she led him past the reception area toward a narrow staircase. Jim noted that the woman navigated the steps easily in heels. By the third flight of stairs, Jim was surprised to find that he was nowhere near winded. For nearly a decade, he had relied on elevators, but a month of continual sword training in a cell had improved his endurance. They turned down a hallway, and Jim glanced from side to side, catching brief flashes of industrial studio space and stadium seating classrooms crammed with young men and women. Near the end of the hallway, a door, partially open, allowed a view of a naked woman sitting provocatively on a chair. Jim flushed red, which Dominique noticed. "I've been here off and on for 7 years, and I still can't get over the fact that they don't shut the door during nude modeling sessions." Jim nodded. "I never thought of myself as prudish," he replied. "But I guess European mores are just more..." Jim paused, looking for a diplomatic word. "Permissive." Dominique shrugged. "Well, I am not a prude, but the obsession with nude models at this school is classist and predatory." Dominique reached her office, unlocked the door, and motioned for Jim to take a seat in one of the visitor chairs arranged about the coffee table. Dominique sat in the other and continued to explain her objection to the Academy Julian's practice. "There's no real education value in it, as the style currently taught is more abstract, and there's no commercial value in it, because the demand for nude art has plummeted. People don't want to pay 7,000 francs for a moderately tasteful nude painting, when internet porn can titillate any taste." Jim nodded, but his attention was on trying to find a place to set his sword cane. He was uncomfortably aware of the phallic symbolism of manipulating his cane, but he eventually found a place using his left leg to pin it against the arm of the chair. "Of course, it was never really about art," Dominique continued. "The artists flirt with the models, and the students and teachers offer modeling gigs to women as pickup lines. The whole practice is just an elaborate system to connect the children of the wealthy with the young and beautiful and financially desperate of Paris." Dominique toyed irritably with the series of bangles at her wrist. "It's a tradition, and I'm not really French, so who am I to call out the practice that dates back to Bouguereau and probably before?" Jim smiled. "Somehow I get the sense that you haven't held back." Dominique returned an arch smile, affirming that Jim had read her correctly. She pivoted the conversation. "Your travel from London went smoothly, Dr. Galgadet?" she asked. "I exchanged money in Calais," Jim explained, "and took the train, transferring to a line headed for Paris." "And you found a place to stay?" Jim nodded. "I'm staying at the Hotel Saint-Germain," Jim explained. "It's around the corner." Dominique smiled. "I know," she said. There was an awkward silence. Jim was uncertain how to broach the topic of the book when Dominique took over. "So our mutual friends in London said you were interested in Unaussprechlichen Kulten." Jim shrugged. "Maybe. I'm not really sure. I think I know enough to know the book is cursed, but I guess I'd like to understand what that actually means." Dominique sat for a minute, fiddling with her bangles. "Well, I don't know if there is a straight answer to that question. The book itself has been dangerous to own, and the content has been described as sanity stripping." Dominique paused to look at Jim. "I know that sounds hard to believe." Jim shook his head slowly. "I'm familiar." The words came out slowly and quietly. Dominic took the meaning. "I'm sorry," she said. They sat for a minute. "I thought the book was in German," Jim said, after the silence had become uncomfortable. "What's the connection with France?" "Well," Dominic began, leaning back into her chair, "for nearly 200 years, up until Vichy France, Paris was the place to be for occult practitioners, and that book was part of what brought it all to an end." Dominic laid an arm across the armrest of her chair. The bangles on her left wrist slid down to pool against the flare of her hand. "I can say with confidence that one of the few surviving copies of the original printing of Uno Sprechlichen Quilten was in the possession of the occultist Eliphas Levy in 1870. It's thought, but it's less certain, that the book passed to Levy's disciple, Stanislas de Gaeta, and may have been central to de Gaeta's magical war with the former priest Abbé Boulan, but that's pure speculation." Jim furrowed his brow as a wave of names rushed at him. He patted his shirt pocket and pulled out a small notebook and pen. "What does a magical war look like?" Jim asked, trying to buy time to scribble down names and set up a basic timeline of events. Dominic paused. "I couldn't say. Boulan was involved in some pretty dark stuff. It wasn't just the sexual rituals or the cult of personality. There are rumors that he was defrocked for killing an infant while performing a Catholic mass. There's a whole novel, La Basse or some such, about Boulan's fight with de Gaeta. It's kind of a hatchet job on de Gaeta, who's depicted as a demon sorcerer engaged in the darkest arts." "Darker than infanticide?" Jim asked. Dominic shrugged. "It was propaganda. France was broken after the Franco-Prussian War. It was split between Republicans and Royalists, there were Catholics and anti-Catholics, and there was a split between the bourgeois and the socialists. And each group had its factions. De Gaeta's Rosicrucians bridged the socialist and anti-Catholic factions." "So who won the magical war?" Jim asked. "I would call it a draw," Dominic replied, "but people can disagree. Boulan died in 1893, and his followers blamed De Gaeta. But the truth is both groups were being hunted." "The church?" Jim asked. It seemed a fair guess. He wasn't very well versed in French history, but he could fit puzzle pieces together. Rome would almost certainly have a stake in putting down a rogue priest and stomping a brood of Rosicrucian occultists. "The church was certainly a force," Dominique countered, "but the real danger was a faction of the royalists that was plotting to use occult tools to bring about an Orleanist restoration. De Gaeta's group was a threat to those plans, and his followers were being killed off one by one. I'm fairly confident that de Gaeta had Levy's copy of Uno Sprechlichen Quilten, but as the Rosicrucians began to splinter, they went underground, which made it impossible to know which faction held the book." Jim sighed. "That's unfortunate," he said. "The book could be anywhere." "Well, it's unfortunate for us today, but splintering kept the anti-Catholic occult groups alive. If the Royalists had captured Uno Sprechlichen Quilten, their bid for power would have almost certainly succeeded, and that Dr. Gal-Gadet would have been the sum of all horrors." Jim wrote "sum of all horrors" in his notebook and then followed it with "Royalists equal bad." He underlined "bad" several times. While he worked, Dominique set about heating water in an electric kettle. She asked if he wanted tea, and he accepted. When the kettle began to whistle, Dominique poured two cups, added a splash of lemon to hers, and delivered the mugs to the coffee table. 1895 was a bad year, she began as she dropped a tea bag into the steaming water. The King in Yellow had been published and was circulating widely in Paris and even the outlying provinces. There were parts of Paris where the yellow banner hung from almost every building, and the royalists were preparing Philippe VIII to become the avatar of the King in Yellow. They arranged for him to complete the rites needed to claim the Grand Mastership of the Order of the Holy Spirit. Jim stopped. I'm sorry, I just don't know what any of that is. Who's the King in Yellow? Dominique laughed. It was a full and musical sound. Dr. Gal-Gadet, you might as well ask, what is hell? It's a symbol, and a place, and a curse, and a metaphor. And so too is the King in Yellow. It's the name of a play that, it's sort of a mindfuck, but it's also a person, or it could be a person. There's a king, but the king is one of many avatars of some force, powerful and alien. Dominic paused, realizing she'd lost Jim again. Haster? She offered. Jim shook his head, indicating that he'd never heard the word before. It doesn't really matter, Dominic said. The royalist push to make Philippe VIII the King in Yellow failed. At the last minute, the Catholics broke with the royalists and joined the Republicans to suppress the disciples of Haster. That horrid play was burned and the yellow sign was banned. Jim scribbled several additional lines of notes. It was clear that Dominique favored the secular occultists over the royalists or the Catholics, but the whole mess just seemed insane. Was that the end of it? Jim asked. The Unaussprechlichen Kulten was lost, the occult rivals of the Geita were beaten back. Dominique's brow wrinkled as she crooked her head to the side ever so slightly. You really don't know any of this? She asked. No, Jim snapped more testily than he had intended. He was tired, and sore, and confused, and he desperately wanted a drink. I'm a satellite engineer. We don't pay attention to this sort of thing in the STEM fields. Well, my doctorate is in art history, Dominique said flatly, and we do pay attention to this sort of thing, because it is important. I'm sorry, Dr. Jackson, I wasn't trying to start a pissing contest. Jim blushed at the scatological reference, and then rushed to change the subject. Do you specialize in French art? Dominique gestured to a string of paintings along the wall. Late 19th century art more generally, she explained. And I wasn't trying to put you on the spot. I was just surprised this wasn't already familiar to you. Michael said you were something of a savant in matters of the occult and were well connected back in the States. Jim shook his head. I'm good at puzzles. I've read. Jim trailed off. I'm kind of new to all this, he finished. He took a sip of tea and hoped Dominique would not press him further. The tea was earthy, comforting, and familiar. Well, Dr. Gal-Gadet, things got much worse in France after the suppression of the King in Yellow. The French right reformed and rebuilt multiple militant organizations. For 30 years, those groups waged violence in the streets and assassinated their political and spiritual enemies. Dominique withdrew the tea bag from the mug and set it carefully on a saucer, while Jim scribbled dutifully in his notepad. The right-wing groups were only suppressed when the socialists, Masons, and Rosicrucians were able to unify in 1936 as the Popular Front. It worked, but... The phone rang, and Dominique rose up to answer it, leaning casually against her desk as she brought the phone to her ear. Jim glanced around the room, trying not to look like he was listening to the conversation. He looked at bookcases lined with volumes of art history, popular management, and marketing texts. When he looked back at Dominique, her posture had changed. The woman was rigid. She was gripping the phone, and her hand was over her mouth as if stifling a cry. Jim's attention was galvanized. The woman's eyes were wide with terror as she made quiet, affirmative sounds for several more minutes. When she hung up, she walked stiffly, even clumsily, to the corner where her stylish black trench coat hung on a coat hook. She swept the coat around her. Jim, she said, voice controlled, let's go for a walk. You should see a bit of Paris before you leave, and I need some fresh air. Is everything all right? Jim asked, knowing from her body language that it was not. It was some bad news. I think a walk will help me clear my head, and I would welcome the company. Jim nodded, picking up his sword cane and gesturing with it that she should lead the way. They scrolled east along the Seine. The morning sun brushed light across the cool water. They walked on the pedestrian path while cars zipped along to their right. The walk was indeed refreshing, and Jim was glad for the chance to stretch his legs. They had taken a side passage out of the Académie Julian, slipping through a loose panel in a 6-foot wrought iron barrier topped with spikes. Jim had made a comment about escaping out the back, which Dominique had laughed off, saying that the shortcut was well used by students. The back alley was narrow and twisted between buildings, but eventually came out onto Rue du Dragon, well north of Académie Julian. From there, it was a short walk to the Pont d'Ars bridge, and then east. Jim felt some small bit of contentment in the cool river air, the crisp morning sun, and the sights and sounds of Paris. To the right was an unending line of official-looking buildings in a Baroque or possibly Rococo style. Jim couldn't quite place the age of the buildings, but they looked old. Across the Seine was a picturesque jumble of old-world buildings. At points, the beauty of the city took his breath away. There was something utterly magical about it. The architecture, the history. Jim had always considered romantic attachments to place to be sentimental foolishness. But looking out across the Seine, he understood how a person could become psychologically bound to a place. He felt like Hemingway, or those other famous expats that he couldn't recall names for. That seemed like the kind of thing Dominique would probably know, because it was important in her world. Jim noted that Dominique's stiffness hadn't faded as they walked. If anything, she seemed to be winding tighter. At several points, she stopped to watch the water, pointing out a gray heron or a flock of gulls wheeling above the water. Jim noticed that when they stopped, the woman would do a careful visual sweep of the area. Feeling a need to pull Dominique away from whatever had darkened her thoughts, Jim made an attempt at conversation. How did a nice American girl become a leading expert on 19th century French occultism? Dominique flashed a sideways glance at the older man before answering. I guess I just wanted to understand my parents, she said. Were you close? Jim asked. The question elicited a shrug from Dominique. For a time, she watched a large bird striking down at the water. My father was one of the black GIs that decided life was better in France than under Jim Crow. He married a French woman and worked as a painter in Paris. Is that the art connection? Jim asked. Dominique again flashed Jim a sideways look, eyes narrow. No, he painted rooms. It took skill, but it wasn't art. They walked for a bit, and Jim was about to press for more when Dominique returned to her personal history. My father was conflicted about returning to the United States. He wanted to be part of the civil rights movement, but he had married a French woman, and there was no way to bring his wife and daughter back to Georgia. Jim nodded, not really understanding, but trying to indicate he was listening. After 1967, my father decided he wanted to return to the States, but my mother didn't want to leave Paris. We moved in time to start my senior year of high school in Atlanta. What happened in 1967? Jim asked, conscious that his historical illiteracy was again on display. Dominique stopped and turned to study Jim. The Supreme Court ruling in Loving versus Virginia, she said flatly. The court case that ended state bans on interracial marriage. Oh, Jim responded. He felt like an idiot. He vaguely remembered the case from when he was in high school, but it had seemed unimportant at the time. No, that wasn't right. He had thought about the case in terms of politics, but not in terms of people. The realization made him uncomfortable, and he felt a pressing need to shift the subject away from race. So that explains the connection to France, he said. But what about the occult? Dominique smiled. My mother's grandmother, which I guess would be my maternal great-grandmother, spent more time with the German version of Unaussprechlichen Kulten than any other human save the compiler Friedrich von Jungst. The book is something of a family legend. Jim nodded. Was she a scholar? Dominique's response was cool and unapologetic. My great-grandmother was a whore, she said. A pair of women walking toward them clearly heard Dominique's declaration. One of the women gave Dominique a glare, which Dominique met unflinchingly. The women walked on, having gotten the worse for the interaction. So, Jim said after the two women were well away, how is your great-grandmother connected to the book? Dominique inclined her head to the right, indicating that they should turn south onto the Rue de Seine. It's kind of an interesting story, at least I always thought it was. As I heard it, after Friedrich von Jungst's death, most of the copies of his book were burned. But his nephew spirited one copy away and kept it hidden. When Prussia invaded France, the young von Jungst saw an opportunity to smuggle the book into France, where it would be safe. My great-grandmother, Elizabeth Russet, was a peasant girl from Alsace, who joined up with the Prussian forces as a camp follower. The story is that after fucking her, von Jungst paid her to break from the Prussian advance and bring the book to Eliphas Levy in Paris. It took nearly a month to make the trip, but she arrived well ahead of the Prussian army. What my mother told me is that Levy spent several years trying to find someone to translate the book into French. The scholars he managed to hire either quit or ended up committing suicide. Eventually, the sorcerer tracked Elizabeth down. It was a desperate hunch that happened to be right. Levy figured that as an Alsatian, Elizabeth would presumably be fluent in both German and French. It further seemed likely that she would have read portions of the book, and as far as he could tell, had managed to retain her sanity. They stopped at a street corner and waited for the lights to shift. Jim glanced at the newsstand at the corner of the street. He had largely lost track of news and pop culture during his time with the D Society. He noticed copies of a new Harry Potter book, at La Chamber des Secrets. There was also an inordinate amount of pornography. Jim shifted his attention back to the crossing light. When they started to move, Dominique renewed her story. He found her working in the streets of the Latin Quarter. Elizabeth was hired to produce a French version of Unaussprechlichen Kulten. She managed to translate more than half the book before Levy died. And then payment stopped. After that, the book disappeared, and Elizabeth destroyed the translation and all of her notes. My grandmother said that her mother described the book as filthy. Jim listened as they walked. He wondered if Dominique had steered them into the Latin Quarter on purpose, or if it was just a coincidence that they were wandering the very streets that her great-grandmother had walked. Dominique, this is going to sound stupid, but why would von Jungst think the book would be safe in France? From what you said, France was crawling with occult factions. Do you belong to a secret society, Dr. Galgadet? Dominique asked. Jim blanched at the question, but Dominique seemed to take it as rhetorical and pushed ahead without requiring an answer. Most secret societies are simply peasants sneaking out into the forest on astrologically significant nights. They dance naked with demons and fuck their neighbors, and are back in their huts by sunup. Anything more sophisticated takes literacy, money, and leisure time. For most of human history, secret societies, real secret societies, were the province of the nobility. The Industrial Revolution changed that, created a whole class of people with the financial means to participate in secret societies. Most middle-class American men dabbled in the occult. For some, it's Masonic lodges that sponsor children's hospitals and circuses. For others, it's terrorizing black people with burning crosses. Jim was about to object, but he had no actual point to make, so he stayed his tongue. I dated a man who belonged to a secret society within the Boy Scouts. As best I could tell, it involved wearing Native American ceremonial dress and hazing teenage boys. Jim nodded. The Order of the Arrow, he said, mouth dry. Dominique chuckled. Better than the Klan, I suppose. Jim again wanted to object to her assessment, but he couldn't find any particular point where she was wrong. Still, he felt the need to respond, and was about to assert himself when Dominique picked up the thread of the conversation. The United States and France are unique, in that middle-class secret societies are common, while aristocratic societies are rare. The United States never had a nobility to be drawn into the darkest of occult practices over the course of generations. In France, the nobility was culled by the guillotine. Whether by intent or accident, the Reign of Terror broke the power of France's secret aristocratic societies. Jim tried to draw Dominique's line of reasoning into an explanation. So, von Jungst feared aristocratic cults, and even though France was about to be invaded, it would be safer than Germany, where aristocrats still held sway. Dominique nodded. That's a concise way of putting it, she said. I would just add that this predates German unification. Jim nodded. He'd heard about German unification at some point, and he thought it had something to do with Charlemagne, but the timeline didn't seem to make sense. Jim decided not to ask for clarification. It probably wasn't important. Also, Dominique said, the younger von Jungst was desperate to get rid of the book. The man was terrified of it. Maybe he feared death like his uncle experienced, or maybe he read some of the book and it broke him. Jim thought about his own experience with the Soviet files. My money's on the latter, he said. Dominique turned her head to look at him. She was studying him. The attention made Jim uncomfortable, prompting him to ask how Friedrich von Jungst died. He was strangled, Dominique said flatly. He was strangled in broad daylight by invisible hands, while dozens of people looked on, unable to help him. Jim nodded. They reached the Rue de Vaugirard and turned off onto a footpath leading into the northeast quadrant of Jardin du Luxembourg. The morning walk along the Seine had been refreshing, but in the forested park the air had an earthy taste. They had not gone far into the park when Dominique made for a bench. She patted the seat next to her, indicating Jim should join her. Jim noted the oddity of the bench, which faced away from the Palace du Luxembourg. Before them was an open lawn, dotted with trees, and a single statue of bronze about 40 feet off in the near distance. The statue was nothing special, and Jim was about to comment on it when Dominique spoke. I have a hypothesis about what happened to Unaussprechlichen Kulten. Would you like to hear it? She asked. Jim nodded. Dominique took a deep breath. Do you see that statue? She asked. Jim affirmed that he did. I started coming here to this bench once a week about 3 years ago. It's a monument to students who died in the resistance to the Nazi occupation, Dominique explained. There was a German doctor by the name of von Lassen who helped hunt down the resistance. Von Lassen was considered a madman by the Berlin scientists at Tiergartenstrasse. When Hitler suspended the T4 operations in August 1941, von Lassen moved to Paris, where he connected with the pro-Vichy militia. As she talked, Dominique slipped a shoe off and rubbed at her heel and the outer edge of her foot. Jim noticed the flash of neon green toenail polish as Dominique worked her hand against her sole. His wife had gotten a pedicure once, and the paint had chipped away in less than a week. Jim had casually adopted his wife's view that nail polish was frivolous and utterly impractical, and yet the spark of green against Dominique's dark toes was quite attractive. Jim realized he was staring, pulled his eyes off toward the statue. I never heard of von Lassen, Jim said, trying to keep his eyes off Dominique's toes. He blushed at the idea that the woman might think him one of those men with an aberrant, maybe even sexual interest in feet. Was he tried at Nuremberg? Jim asked. Dominique gave a haunted chuckle. No, thank God, she said. The man's a monster, and if he ever dies, I hope he burns for all eternity, but... Dominique pressed her lips. Things he did need to be forgotten. Jim's brow furrowed. The Nazis killed like 6 million Jews, and a bunch of socialists and gays, and I think gypsies. What could this guy possibly have done that needed to be swept under the rug? Dominique looked about, ensuring no one was within earshot. Necromancy, she whispered. Jim started to smile, but disciplined the reaction. Dominique was serious. How could that be? I talked with one of his assistants. The doctor figured out an alchemical process to distill a human body down to a crystal powder which could be used to bring a person's consciousness back to life in a recently dead body. That's ridiculous, Jim said. That isn't how human physiology works. Dominique's eyes narrowed. It's not a new concept, she said with an edge of defensiveness in her voice. Borlase wrote about it centuries ago. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but he wrote, "The essential salts of animals may be prepared and preserved such that an ingenious man may retain the whole of Noah's Ark for his study, and at his pleasure raise the shape of an animal from its ashes. By such a method, the essential salts of humans may be also so prepared that a philosopher may, without any criminal necromancy, call up the shape of an ancestor." Jim listened. He was trying to take the concept of non-criminal necromancy seriously, but he couldn't understand how a human could be rendered into salts, or how salts could be revived into a human. It made no sense. "Did the assistant say how the process was done?" Jim asked. Dominique stared at Jim for a long time. "The assistant didn't help with the necromantics," she said finally. "He assisted with the torture." Jim blanched, realization coming to him. Dominique pressed the point home. "If a suspected supporter of the resistance was killed, the body would be brought to Von Lazen. The doctor would distill the essence of the individual down, and then inflict the soul upon some fresh corpse. The revived consciousness of that resistance fighter would then be tortured to death. The process would be repeated until every scrap of information had been extracted, and twice confirmed." "Oh, shit," Jim said. He felt sick. He looked out at the bronze statue. It was of a gaunt, abstract figure, holding position, while a second figure tangled about its legs. Jim stared at the statue and ached. "Yeah," Dominique said. She offered nothing more. They both sat for a time, staring at the monument. When a church bell called out the hour, Dominique was moved to speak. "Von Lazen didn't just hunt the resistance," she said. "He hunted France's occult sects, too. He was looking for something." "The book," Jim croaked. His throat had gone hoarse. He reached into his fanny pack and pulled out a small orange pill bottle. He opened it, tapped a pill into his hand. He snapped the pill in half and dry swallowed the smaller portion before returning the valium to his fanny pack. "I would bet money," Dominique said, "that if the Levy copy of Unaussprechlichen Kulten survived, it left France in Dr. Von Lazen's hands." Jim nodded. "That is something," he said, uncertain what that something actually was. Dominique nodded, then she let out a deep sigh. "Jim, I've been holding something back, and I think it's time to come clean." Jim turned to the woman, suddenly alarmed. "The phone call I received was from Michael." Dominique paused, but James' lack of reaction to the name prompted her to elaborate. "The director of the D Society," Dominique explained. "He said that your colleague from North Dakota is dead. He and his escort were ambushed 2 days ago. Your colleague was abducted and tortured. Something resembling a body was found this morning by a London sanitation crew. They just managed to confirm the identity." Jim was confused and shocked. "Jesus. Or Tim. Who did this?" Dominique raised her hands, indicating she had no answer. "Most likely it's the same group that attacked the archives." She paused. "Michael thinks they were looking for you." Jim closed his eyes. The whole trip had been a fucking disaster. Jim thought about the tortures used by the Soviet Union in treating those who questioned the party and thus suffered from political insanity. Strips of wet cloth would be wrapped about a subject. As the fabric dried, it would constrict, cutting off circulation, restricting breathing. The body would slowly die, while the mind panicked and raged helplessly. Jim looked out at the monument and realized tears were streaming down his face. He hated humanity, himself most of all. Dominique was talking. Her words seemed far away, but Jim managed to catch the basic thrust. "You've got to go to ground, Jim," she said. "I wish I could offer you shelter, but I can't. When we get up off this bench, you're going in different directions." Jim wiped tears from his face with a rough palm. His tear ducts felt hot and raw in a way he remembered from childhood. "What does go to ground mean?" Jim asked. Reactive masculinity congratulated him on keeping his voice steady. There was no quaver or crack that might suggest he had lost control of himself. Jim felt a new line of tears reach critical mass and slide down his face. "You need to disappear," Dominique was saying. "You are being hunted, and you need to assume that whoever is behind this has the resources of a state." She paused to correct herself. "They have the resources of all states." Dominique's voice cracked, presumably from fear. Jim snarled inwardly. He would not show weakness. He would not show fear. Part of him wondered if the Valium was the difference between holding it together and snapping. He considered taking another pill, but he needed his wits. He needed the fear. Dominique placed a hand on his shoulder. "When you stand up from this bench, Jim Galgadet dies. Don't stand up until you're ready to do this." Jim bit at his lower lip. His body shuddered involuntarily as he drew in a breath. He did a check of what he had to draw on. He had perhaps 600 francs. He had a passport and a Eurorail pass. He was armed with a sword cane and a pocket knife. He had a phone card, a camera, a notepad, a pen, clothes on his back. Jim shuddered a second time and hissed a series of expletives augmenting the word fuck. He was in Paris. He was in France. He was in the Schengen area. There was an airport in Norway that the university used to train pilots. The situation was bad, but he had options. Pieces moved in his mind, sliding, shifting, realigning. He could see a way out. The tightness in his chest relaxed, and he managed to take a breath. "I'll head for..." "I don't want to know," Dominique said. Her tone was curt, but Jim recognized the subtext. What she didn't know, she couldn't betray under torture. Jim wiped tears from his face one last time. "It was a pleasure to meet you, Dr. Jackson. Truly." Jim took hold of his sword cane, threw his backpack over his shoulder. "If you're ever in North Dakota, please look me up." Dominique smiled. "I sincerely hope I won't be able to find you, Dr. Galgadet." "Touché," Jim said. He stood. The lights of the town flashed through the windows of the train car, illuminating the otherwise dark and empty room. Jim had been pleased to get a compartment to himself for most of the overnight line to Salzburg. It had been easier to catch catnaps on the seat in an empty compartment than when there had been others around. Jim had been cautious. He had not returned to his hotel room to retrieve a few changes of clothes he had brought with him from London. He had picked up some basic toiletries and a stack of postcards at a corner shop. Jim had spent the afternoon working on the postcards before hailing a cab for Charles de Gaulle Airport. At the airport, he had placed a phone call to London. The conversation with Karen left a pit in his stomach. The woman had pretended to not know him, insisted he had the wrong number, told him to stop calling her, to leave her alone. Jim had taken the hint, dumped his phone card into the trash, and hailed a cab for Paris Nord train station. Before exiting the cab, Jim had given the driver a letter and 100 francs. Jim had pointed to a random spot on the map and asked the driver to drop the letter in a mailbox somewhere in that region. Jim was reasonably sure the letter to his wife would actually post. If not, he planned to send a second letter from somewhere in Austria. At the first stop of the eastbound train, he had dropped the first of 7 stacks of postcards. The bundle of 30 or so cards was divided among 3 different mailboxes at the train station. Each postcard was covered with dots, code that would be recognizable to the Chester Fritz professors and few others. Jim imagined the flurry the cards would set off when they started arriving in mailboxes in North Dakota. There would be a small army of people preparing the way for his return. He just needed to stay alive. Jim had determined that he would spend 2 weeks sleeping on trains, switching at medium-sized cities, picking destinations randomly. He would use the Schengen zone's lax passport controls and a grueling travel schedule to shake any surveillance. He would buy himself time. 2 weeks for his postcards to arrive. 2 weeks to build a new identity from whole cloth. 2 weeks to grow a beard. There were so many details to work out on both sides of the Atlantic. Jim knew that he would need a new passport, social security card, and driver's license, but he had little sense of how that might be accomplished. He needed to figure out how to keep his wife safe, There was a non-trivial chance that the summer would be the end of his marriage. Things had been collapsing for more than a year. He had noticed it most concretely after the attack on the library, but the truth was they'd been drifting apart for a decade. The train deaccelerated and eventually stopped. Jim checked his watch and noted it was somewhere around 3 a.m. He couldn't recall the scheduled stops, but he didn't think that they would pass any major cities before dawn. Jim shifted himself to lean against the opposite wall of the compartment. There wasn't really space to lie down, but he wanted to minimize soreness as much as possible. Jim worked himself into something approximating a comfortable position. He pondered what he actually wanted. He'd spent the day staring out at a scrolling French countryside, unable to resolve the most basic question. Did he want to go back? How would that work? Would that be better for him? Would that be better for his wife? The answers were a spinning dial that wouldn't stop. The more he thought, the faster the dial spun. The door to the train compartment slid open, and a man stepped in. Jim prevented his groan from registering audibly. He needed sleep, but it would not come with a stranger seated across from him. He should have gotten off and slept in an alley or a bench. The nights weren't that cold. Jim debated what to do. He watched the man through slitted eyes. The man was big. Not huge, but big enough. He also seemed uninterested in sleep. As the train began to roll forward, the cabin door opened again, and the ticket clerk stepped in. He processed the new passenger's ticket, gave a slight nod to Jim, indicating that he recognized him from earlier, and left. 30 minutes later, Jim groggily pulled himself to his feet. Staying put was not going to work. He needed a safe place to sleep, and if that meant locking himself in the bathroom stall for 2 hours, he was more than willing to do so. Jim retrieved his sword cane and his backpack, which held a small fraction of the possessions he had started with when he flew into Heathrow, as well as a handful of more recent acquisitions. He turned to exit the compartment. The garrote slipped around his neck. Jim dropped the backpack, his hand reaching up to claw at the strip of silk cloth tightening about his throat. Jim's hands worked with little effect against the cloth, trying to force fingers between his windpipe and the fabric. The rational part of his brain noted that wire would be more lethal than cloth. Yet as the flow of blood through his carotid artery slowed, rational functioning of his brain went dark and the primal part assumed control. He was being kidnapped. Again. He had to fight. Jim punched back at his assailant as best he could, but even if he had managed to land a blow, it would have accomplished little. Jim threw his weight forward toward the door. He collided and bounced back. The garrote loosened for perhaps a second before the deadly constriction returned. That second was enough. Jim reached up and took hold of his assailant's hands and levered himself up off the ground. His legs came up bent. He rotated his hips so that his feet were facing the door. Jim kicked out with all the force he could manage. The two flew across the compartment, crashing into the glass and steel frame of the train car. Jim's assailant was trapped between steel of the train and the momentum of Jim's body. The assailant's rib cage collapsed, and his grip on the garrote gave out. Jim was on his feet. With a twist of his sword cane, the 30-inch wood shaft slid free, revealing a rapier blade. Jim heard the door open. Muscle memory drilled 10,000 times in his prison cell took control. Jim pivoted. The new entrant was perhaps 2 feet from Jim. Pistol out, held at hip level. Jim's rapier snapped up. Jim rotated his torso, sword connecting with the steel of the gun and pushing it offline. Jim rolled his wrist into the second guard and stabbed forward. The effect was nothing like training. Where in the past he had encountered the resistance of a blunt-tipped blade meeting body armor, there was only a wobble of the blade as it found its path between ribs and through vital organs. The man slumped to the ground, his weight pulling on the blade as the body slid from the steel. The train compartment seemed to be roaring. The noise of the rattle of the tracks was joined by the wheezing and gurgling of the man that had tried to strangle Jim. Satisfied that the second attacker was dead and that a third was not about to charge through the door, Jim turned his attention to the first man. Jim sat down on a seat. His legs felt like jelly. The floor was slick with blood, and the cabin smelled of piss. Jim checked himself to confirm that he hadn't lost bladder control. "English?" he asked the man slumped on the floor. The man was clearly struggling to breathe, and Jim didn't expect much of an answer, but was pleasantly surprised when the man nodded. "If I ask you questions, will you tell me the truth?" Jim asked as he wiped the rapier blade clean on the dead man's pant leg, before retrieving the wooden shaft that fitted around the blade. The man wheezed, shook his head, indicating that he had no intention of being cooperative. Jim shrugged in response. He leaned forward, worked his hands into the pockets of the dead assailant, retrieving wallet, passport, an additional magazine for a pistol, and little else. Jim pocketed the passport and pulled a small stack of cash from the wallet. A small scrap of paper fell out, landing on the seat next to Jim. After placing the newly acquired stack of miscellaneous European currencies into his wallet, Jim turned his attention to the scrap of paper. There were pencil markings and symbols that he didn't immediately recognize. Greek? Cyrillic? It was hard to tell in the darkness of the train compartment. Jim fingered the paper. It felt strange. On a hunch, he licked his finger and set it against a blank corner. The paper dissolved into a slimy goop almost as soon as it came in contact with moisture. Interesting, Jim observed, tearing the gooey corner away from the rest of the note and tucking the remaining scrap into his wallet for later study. He returned his attention to the still-living assailant. I should kill you, he told the man, while reaching forward to search for a wallet, weapons, and documents. But then again, maybe I already have, Jim observed. The man's breathing seemed to whistle. While Jim was not medically trained, he suspected the man had punctured a lung. From what he had learned from watching episodes of ER, that would lead to fluid filling the lung and then infection. The way George Clooney described it, it sounded like a terrible way to die. Jim pocketed a second passport and another stack of cash before turning his attention back to the dying man. If you live, Jim said, tell your employers that Jim Galgadet is coming for them. Jim leaned forward. And if you die, try to get a good table in hell. You're going to have lots of company. The train began to slow. Jim raised his sword cane and smashed out a window with the blunt metal ball in the base of the cane. Glass exploded outward, leaving the compartment surprisingly free of shards and filled with the damp night air. Jim slipped on his backpack, slid his sword cane behind his shoulder strap, and eased himself out the window. He hung along the side of the train as it approached the station. He dropped onto the ground with a dangerous tumble, a good 100 meters from the train station. Jim landed, knee colliding with a stone or a concrete block. He swore, pushed himself to his feet, and walked away. Thank you for listening, and your patience and pardon for my terrible French pronunciation. I should also confess that I haven't been to Paris, even though the physical geography of the city, particularly of the Latin Quarter, is at the center of the story. If you're not familiar with the Yellow Mythos, I would encourage you to read Robert Chambers' short story, The Repairer of Reparations. The story is part of a collection titled The King in Yellow. While the first couple stories are cosmic horror honed to perfection, the last batch of stories build off of Chambers' own time in Paris as an art student at the Académie Julian. While these later stories lack any supernatural elements, they remain quite magical. I hope I've captured some small part of their charm in The Académie Julian.